You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. Hey folks, welcome to the show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Those of you who are joining us for the very first time, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. You need to know, if you're brand new, that we have a free weekly newsletter and we'd like for you to be part of it. You can get it free. All you have to do is go over to my website at kevinsmithshow.com. And when you get over there, just look for the little red, well, it's a little button, and in red letters it says K-Files e-zine, all right? So look for the K-Files e-zine. It takes about 10 seconds to subscribe, and you're going to get a confirmation email with a link in it for you to click. And when you do that, you're in. Speaking of email, just received an email regarding Dick Criswell. You know, those of you who have been listening for some time, Dick Criswell has been a guest on this show quite a number of times, and he is the founder and director of IPUS, the International Paranormal UFO Society. And the email that I got says that Dick had a stroke on Sunday morning. He is in the hospital. He is able to get up and walk around as long as he has someone there to support him. He can't walk on his own, but he is able to get up and walk around. There are some other complicating medical issues. They are having a prayer vigil for him, a prayer session for him, tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern time, which has already taken place. I would have told you sooner, but I didn't find out until just before showtime. And so even though we missed out on that 9 p.m. time, I'm sure that Dick would certainly appreciate your best thoughts and prayers for his recovery. In the news, I read an article about the pyramids and tours that people take to the Great Pyramid. You know, that's a part of the world, and that's a subject that we talk about on this show quite frequently. And so it caught my eye. I want you to listen to this. I want you to listen. The last seven wonders of the world to still be standing, the pyramids generate obsessive fervor among archaeologists, Egyptologists, aliens built the pyramid fanatics, historians, kids, climbers, and just about anyone with a fascination for the world. It also talks about people paying big bucks to take part in the, quote, wacky New Age spiritual tours. All right, now, you know, if you listen to this show, you know that lights my fuse. It is not people who think there may have been alien intervention that are fanatics. It is the Egyptologist who want you to believe that that could be built in the lifetime of one Pharaoh when it can't be built today with our modern technology. We'll be back. My guest is Robert Hastings, and we're going to have a great time. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com. Alien Seeker News has blasted off and is providing a new and important resource for everyone interested in UFOs, aliens, alien abductions, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and more. Featuring five of the top UFO radio talk shows, lots of information and articles in free forums, Alien Seeker News has launched on its journey to greatness. Go to AlienSeekerNews.com, register for the free forums, and get the classic Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe as a free ebook. Join today.
Galaxy.
Welcome back. My guest this evening is Robert Hastings. This is not his first time with us, but we are delighted to have him back. Robert, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you very much.
When you were with us before, it's been really quite a while since you were with us, but when you were with us before, we began as I would like for us to begin this evening, and that is a little bit of explanation of your background, because we have a lot of new listeners we didn't have then. And so let's start with a little bit of your background and why you are interested in UFOs.
My father was career Air Force, and in 1967 he was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana. I'm picking up an echo, by the way. I can barely hear myself talk. But in any event, at that time at Malmstrom in 1967, there were a number of incidents in which UFOs maneuvered around nuclear missile sites. I became aware of that. in a variety of ways. And so by the early 1970s, I began to research this subject. And over the last 30 years, I have interviewed close to 100 former and retired Air Force personnel who were involved in incidents involving UFOs at nuclear missile sites and weapons storage areas.
All right. Let me ask you if you are still picking up an echo.
Not at this moment, no.
Well, it went away about the time when you said that, and I checked. Everything is set as we always have it. I guess we had a little additional assistance on the line.
Well, I'll tell you, over the years, I've had some rather interesting telephone anomalies. They seem to come shortly after I've talked to one military source or another, or in some cases, research colleagues. So in my view, it's more than statistical chance. There seems to be a little bit of a pattern to it.
All right.
Can't imagine who it might be.
Well, I don't know, and I make no accusations. Speculating that it would seem we may have a little assistance this evening. And, of course, we're grateful for any assistance we can receive.
If they boost the signal, sure.
You studied photography at Ohio University and received your degree in that. You worked on a master's degree, and then eventually you retrained in electron microscopy.
Excellent.
You've been employed as a laboratory analyst for a number of years.
I was until 2002. Mm-hmm. They closed down the plant and laid us all off. So now I'm lecturing and researching full time.
So, I guess, you know, when we look at your background educationally, we don't see something that would jump out and say this guy would be interested in UFOs. Your degree work is all very much feet on the ground kind of stuff, and your interest in UFOs goes way back, though, beyond the degrees. It goes back to being around when there was a lot of UFO activity at some of these bases, right?
That's correct. As I mentioned earlier, had my father not been stationed at Malmstrom during that period, the echo's back, by the way, and had I not been employed as a teenage custodian three nights a week after high school in the air traffic control tower, where I witnessed UFOs being tracked on the screen one night, my interest probably never would have gone in this direction, I would assume.
You've just mentioned it about being in the air traffic control tower, and you shared that with us before. But tell us that story again, because as I said, we have a lot of new listeners that weren't with us when you were here before.
Well, if the echo continues, I can hear everything I'm saying repeated immediately after I say it, so I apologize, but that's the case. In any case, I was a junior in high school in Great Falls, Montana, but I did have a job three nights a week as a custodian in the Malmstrom Air Force Base Air Traffic Control Tower. One of the rooms that I routinely cleaned was called RAPCON, which is Radar Approach Control, and it was a dark room with probably 10 or 12 scopes, I'm guessing, after this many years, in which were manned by both FAA and Air Force air traffic controllers. And over the course of a several-month period, I did make acquaintance with one of the FAA controllers who, at my request, basically tutored me on radar theory and radar operation. I was just curious as to how that all worked. I was only 16 and 17. I'd never had an opportunity to be around or study radar. So he was quite gracious with his time when he was on his breaks answering my questions. And one night, what I've calculated to be mid to late March of 1967, as I walked into the RAPCON room to clean, just empty trash cans and sweep the floor, this same gentleman, just very sort of nonchalantly, called me over to a scope and said, we're tracking five. And I don't know if he said UFOs or unknowns or unidentified targets, but his meaning was clear. And I was quite intrigued by that and asked him a question or two. All he told me was that two jet fighters had been launched to investigate. I tried to ask a couple of more questions, but apparently he was he either felt that he had said too much or he had to get back to monitoring the scope or whatever, but he just more or less brusquely told me to come back and clean later, which I did. When I attempted to bring up the subject with him again, it was clear that he did not want to talk about it, and so he and I never discussed it again. However, I did learn through my father, who worked in a place called the Sage Building. It was a huge windowless blockhouse where they had state-of-the-art radar, that in fact rumors were circulating at Sage about the UFO activity, and further that these UFOs were being sighted as they flew around and maneuvered near the nuclear missile sites east of the base, southeast of the base. So that was pretty intriguing, and that's more or less what kicked off my interest. I'm hoping that your listeners aren't hearing the same echo I am, because I'm sure it's quite annoying.
We're not hearing an echo at all.
Okay.
Yeah, that's something entirely on your side of the telephone there.
Well, after the first break, I'll switch phones and we'll see if we can eliminate it. But as I said, I've had these problems before, and they do seem to have a pattern to them. So I'm not at all surprised about this, to be honest with you.
Robert, you've done a lot of research, and you've done a lot of writing, and you've done a lot of speaking about UFOs seemingly to have a great deal of interest in, like you just described, the nuclear missile sites and nuclear power plants, etc. Let's talk about that a little bit. Why do they seem to have that interest, or do you know?
Well, I've just finished a book that I've been working on for nearly 10 years called UFOs and Nukes, and after this Friday the 18th, it will be available at my website, which is ufohastings.com. 600 pages that are largely interviews with former and retired Air Force personnel describing these incidents. Before I speculate as to what I think is going on, perhaps I should provide a few details to listeners who are not familiar with this type of report. But there are declassified documents from both the U.S. military and the intelligence community going back to the late 1940s indicating that UFOs, flying saucers, flying discs, they're described in a variety of terms, have been sighted repeatedly around nuclear weapons-related facilities. Not too far north of where I live in Albuquerque is the Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratories. In 1945, Los Alamos invented the first atomic bombs, one of which we tested in the deserts of New Mexico, and then two we dropped on Japan to end World War II. Well, by at least as early as December of 1948, according to the declassified documents, approximately 3 years after all of those momentous events occurred, Los Alamos was the focal point for UFO activity in the continental United States. And these objects were sighted repeatedly, not only flying saucers, but also a phenomenon that's come to be called green fireballs. These are objects that appear to be giant fireball meteors, but when they crash into the ground, there's no explosion, there's no debris, and they have been sighted around nuclear weapons facilities, not only in New Mexico, but in Nevada during the era of atomic testing in the 1950s. And there's a research colleague of mine named Dan Wilson, who I strongly recommend your having as a guest, who has done extensive research into sightings of these green fireballs out of the nuclear sites in Nevada and in the United States in general, where they're sighted following areas of radioactive debris, radioactive clouds that are drifting across the United States following these atomic tests on many, many occasions. Dan Wilson has found fireball sightings. These green fireballs seem to be following the paths of the radioactive clouds. In my mind, there's a definite correlation that seems to be involved. When you get into the era of the 1960s and later, when nuclear missiles came online, suddenly there began to be a rash of sightings at our nuclear missile sites. As I mentioned, I've interviewed nearly 100 persons who were at Malmstrom Air Force Base or Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota, Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota, F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming, and Walker Air Force Base in New Mexico. These are missile launch officers, missile targeting officers, missile maintenance officers, and the security guards, the Air Force guards that guarded the missiles. And they're all reporting many, many incursions of UFOs at our nuclear missile sites. There is even one leaked document from 1975 where a lot of activity was occurring in November of 75 at Malmstrom. Someone within the Defense Intelligence Agency leaked that document to an organization called NICAP, and it provided enough information that a Freedom of Information request was filed that permitted the actual transcripts, the government transcripts being released by the Air Force, again confirming that UFOs were repeatedly maneuvering around our ICBMs. Now, cutting to the chase, there are now a number of occasions at these various Strategic Air Command missile bases where the launch officers have told me and another researcher named Jim Klotz and a handful of other researchers that the launch officers were down in the launch capsule 60 feet underground. They received a frantic call from their security guard topside at ground level reporting that a UFO was either hovering over the site or quite near the site. And according to these launch officers, seconds later, their nuclear missiles malfunctioned one after the other. Each launch control capsule contains, controls 10 missiles. The reports that we're getting is that one missile after another, sometimes all 10, sometimes nearly all 10, are malfunctioning one after the other precisely at a time when the UFO is in the area, is in some cases directly above the launch control facility.
What is the most recent of those?
The problem with these kinds of accounts is most of my sources feel they have to wait until they retire or even later to divulge them, because if they were not sworn to secrecy, they were verbally warned not to discuss this, basically take this secret to your grave, and yet they felt, as I do, that the American people have a right to know the facts, and if indeed this is occurring, the public has a right to know that this is going on. So they've come forward one by one and told their stories. I am going to be on Larry King this Friday night with two of those officers and another officer involved in a similar incident. And these gentlemen, again, were entrusted by our government with the operation of weapons of mass destruction, and they're now coming up all over the country and contacting me, or I'm locating them, and they're telling me their stories. So that's gone on consistently, but the problem is, again, something like this may have happened last night, but it may be 20 or 30 years before the people involved are willing to talk with me. I can only tell you in answer to your question that in December of 2006, not even 2 years ago, a civilian up in Montana near a town called Conrad, his house is literally surrounded by nuclear missile sites. He reported on two separate occasions in December of 2006 that he saw UFOs maneuvering quite near his home. And I can tell you also that there is one case on record of this kind of occurrence in the Soviet Union. The ABC reporter at the time in 1994, his name was David Ensor, worked for a program called Primetime Live, and they actually went to the former Soviet Union and interviewed former and retired Soviet Army officers about classified UFO incidents in the Soviet Union. And one of the incidents that was described to this ABC reporter, you can actually find a transcript online, If you search Google for David Ensor Soviet ICBM UFO, something to that effect, you'll find the full transcript of the program where these Soviet officers said that basically a UFO, a saucer-shaped object, hovered above this missile base for several hours at an altitude that not even their anti-aircraft missiles could reach. And after some period of time down in one of their missile launch capsules, the missile launch officers were horrified to see that their missiles had been activated. Some number of missiles that they didn't specify in this program were suddenly preparing to launch, and the automated launch sequence was progressing apace for approximately 15 seconds. And at the end of that 15-second period, this anomaly ceased and everything returned to normal. Now, until a year ago, all of the incidents that I had learned about from American missile launch officers involved, if there was any disruption of the missiles, it involved them going offline, not being able to be launched, as opposed to activating to launch progression. I had never heard of such a case in the U.S. until last August. Last August, I interviewed a former missile launch officer who was at Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, in the mid-60s. He said one night, again down in his underground launch capsule, he and everyone else in the other launch capsules that shared a radio communication heard from their security personnel that a UFO was moving from missile site to missile site, a bright object that was hovering over one missile, then quickly moving to another missile, and so on and so forth. And this launch officer, David Shure, told me that when the object came over his launch area, his 10 missiles, every time it went above one of his missiles down in the launch capsule, they actually got an activated launch sequence, indicating that the missile was preparing to launch. So that's virtually identical to what the Soviet officers had reported to David Ensor years earlier.
Well, something like that happening, it's got to be ulcer time for the launch officer.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's quite clear. I tape record all of my conversations with these persons' permission, and when I type up transcripts to accurately record the conversations in my book, I don't want to misrepresent what they've said. And once I've typed up the conversation, I always send this to the officers to look over, the former and retired officers. And David Shure approved everything I said, everything I wrote in my book about this incident. But he said there were a number of what he called spurious indicators, where not only was the launch activation seemingly enabled, but all sorts of other mechanical issues, the lights on their consoles were indicating anomalies. And he was of the opinion that given that, the missiles probably would never have launched because there were all of these extenuating problems or issues. But nevertheless, these people who, again, you know, these are former and retired Air Force officers, rigorously screen psychologically to make sure that they're reliable and that they can be entrusted with nuclear weapons by our government, are now coming forward all around this country, slowly but surely, and talking about their experiencing these incidents. Now, that was a very long lead-up to your question, but if you're asking me to speculate what I think is going on, what I think is going on is that the technology involved with the UFOs is clearly so superior to human technology, you know, even today in the early 21st century, that clearly we're dealing with somebody from off the earth. One or more races of beings from other worlds have mastered interstellar flight, and for whatever reason, you know, they're probably exploring the whole galaxy. For whatever reason, they have periodically intervened in our nuclear weapons standoff, both here and in the former Soviet Union. That much can be established with very persuasive multiple source anecdotal evidence, testimony from highly credible people. As to the purpose underlying these disruptions and these temporary activations, there you're entirely in the realm of speculation, because These officers are debriefed in some cases. In some cases, they're just told nothing happened. Shut your mouth. Go home.
All right, we have to take a break, Robert. We'll rejoin that thought and that conversation when we come back at the end of this break. We'll be back with Robert Hastings right after this. Right, we are back, and sorry for the little audio strangeness you experienced. We were busy trying to reestablish contact with Robert Hastings, which we have done, hopefully to rid him of the echo that he was experiencing. So let's bring him back online and see. Robert, do you have an echo?
I'm here. Let's see. Yeah, it's back. So we'll just muddle through. wood is metal-free?
All right. Well, I can assure you, we've done nothing to the equipment here.
I don't doubt that for a second. And I was absolutely serious about everything I said earlier. I started having problems with telephones in 1982, shortly after I began speaking on the college lecture circuit about nuclear weapons-related UFO incidents, and started getting some national publicity. Suddenly, when I began talking to my research associates or to ex-military people, I had a host of problems that continue to the present day. So that comes with the territory, apparently.
Well, let's talk. We were about to get into the purpose of the apparent interest that these things have in nuclear sites. What do you think the purpose is?
Well, there's a variety of responses to these incidents. Some launch officers, including Bob Salas, who will appear on Larry King with me this Friday, were sworn to secrecy by OSI agents. OSI is Office of Special Investigation. It's Air Force Counterintelligence Group that has, according to my sources, been involved with suppressing information about these UFO incidents for decades. Other people, again, are just told to go home, but no matter, you know, don't ask questions, don't talk about it, just go home. But no matter how it's handled, all of my sources are saying that no one gave them any feedback, you know, as to what was going on, and so on. There is an exception to that. A targeting officer that I've talked to says that he was told of UFO involvement, but no one, beyond using that terminology, UFO, no one was speculating that these were aliens or, you know, time travelers or anything else. So everyone's been left to speculate for themselves, both my sources and myself. I'm of the opinion, as is Bob Salas and some of my other sources, that these are in fact alien beings, beings from another world, perhaps more than one world, who have in fact mastered what is required for routine interstellar travel and probably have been monitoring our planet for some time.
Now, let me ask you to explain to us why you've come to that conclusion.
Well, again, the technology involved, what people are describing, I mean, anyone familiar with the body of UFO sighting reports going back to the 1940s, there are radar data in many, many cases to indicate that these objects are flying thousands of miles per hour and then instantly either making 90-degree turns, not like gentle arcing turns like aircraft do, but instantaneous 90-degree right-angle turns, or in some cases repeating their course, 180 degrees reversal of course, without any turn whatsoever. There is no technology on Earth when these cases were occurring in the 1940s that would account for that. We may have in Nevada, and I underline may, I don't believe 95% of the stories about Area 51 I've heard, but it's not inconceivable that we may have craft now that can achieve some of those feats, but we certainly didn't in the 1950s, for example, when Washington, D.C. was overflown on two weekends in July when the radar data was so persuasive, the pilots were calling down and saying we're seeing bright lights, and they were finding radar targets to correlate with those lights precisely, and the lights would be flying up to 7,000 miles per hour in one case and doing these radical turns. So again, you know, all of that technology is just so beyond anything we have or the Russians have or anyone else that I think if you don't take into consideration the possibility of time machines, humans from the future coming back, then I think what you're left with as the most likely explanation is that alien races with advanced technology are here, and quite clearly, whatever else is on their agenda, they have an interest in our nuclear weapons capability and have probably been monitoring the nuclear weapons standoff between the superpowers during the Cold War era. But in any case, there are so many sources now who are saying that regardless of who they are, where they're from, why they're here, it's quite clear that they are tampering with our nuclear weapons from time to time. And my understanding is the first half of Larry King's show on Friday night is going to be devoted to my summarizing my research and as well as these three officers describing the incidents that they were involved in.
These guys that are going to be appearing with you on the Larry King Show, at least one of them you've mentioned, was sworn to secrecy. Now, we've all heard that these oaths of secrecy carry with them some rather severe penalties if you violate it. How is he handling that?
Well, the gentleman I'm referring to is Bob Salas, again, who was a launch officer at what was called the Oscar Launch Control Facility at Malmstrom when he got a report from his guard about the missiles being shut down, well, about the UFO being overhead just as the missile shut down. He told me, he's told other researchers, he first worked with a gentleman named Jim Klotz, who is an excellent researcher. He told him and myself that he sweated bullets more or less before going public with this. He first talked about it publicly in the mid-1990s, 1995, I believe, on the program called Sightings. And another Air Force officer came on with him, Don Crawford, and talked about the UFO involvement in the missile shutdowns. So they didn't go forward, they didn't go public lightly. You know, they gave it great consideration, but again, Bob Salas and I have communicated extensively for a decade, and he has told me repeatedly that he believes, as I do, in a democracy such as the United States, the military and the intelligence community should not have a blank check, should not have unquestionable power to keep secret from the public decade after decade the types of incidents that are being described by all of these launch officers and targeting officers. You know, if in fact there's alien visitation going on, if in fact they're disrupting the functionality of our strategic weapon systems, then that's something that Congress should know about and the public and, as far as I'm concerned, the entire planet.
So you don't think that even Congress has known about this?
No, it's these situations, anybody who has done serious research into the way the government handles UFO activity, the very, very sensitive cases seem to involve need to know. You know, you can be a general, but if you're not involved in a certain incident or a certain project, if you don't have need to know, you could have the highest security clearances and you will not know about that particular project or incident. In fact, there are some projects that have, you know, they're so compartmentalized that the various people involved in one aspect or another don't know what the other people are doing, and just to keep the secrecy buttoned down as much as possible. And certainly the Congress, with the exception of perhaps, you know, a handful of people on the Armed Services Committee or the Intelligence Oversight Committees, those people may have a little taste of what's been going on, but I suspect year in and year out, decade in and decade out, they're more or less being told, you don't have a need to know this. In fact, a perfect example of that is Senator Barry Goldwater, who some of your younger listeners may not know the name, but in 1964 he was the Republican candidate for U.S. president and was a right-wing Republican senator for many decades. He was on the Intelligence Oversight Committee. I believe he was the chairman of it in the 70s or around that time. But in any case, Senator Goldwater has said several times, both on Larry King and to other journalists, that he, Senator Goldwater, had heard rumors about a facility at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, in which allegedly was hardware, you know, irrefutable proof of alien, well, of at least UFO visitation. And Goldwater has told Larry King, he's told these other journalists, that he repeatedly, over a several-year period, attempted to gain access to this facility called the Blue Room, and he was rebuffed by chief, quote, chief after chief, meaning chief of staff of the Air Force. He quoted Curtis LeMay, who was chief of staff under Kennedy, Air Force chief of staff, as saying, hell no, you can't go, I can't go, don't ask me again. So even the chief of staff of the Air Force was telling this high-level, powerful U.S. senator that even he though he was a general and chief of staff of the Air Force, he had no need to know about what was within the Blue Room, and neither of them could get in. So that's
and,
the way the real...
Barry Goldwater was not only a senator, he was a general.
That's correct. He was a general in the Air Force Reserves. So my point again is, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of medal you're wearing on your shoulders. If you don't have a need to know about something very sensitive as recovered UFO hardware or UFOs shutting down our nuclear missiles or what have you, you're not going to know about it.
Well, I was about to ask a question, and I glanced over and did something I almost never do. I never watch the clock, and I should, but I happened to see it, and we're 4 seconds away from break. So
right.
I'll ask that question when we come back. Yeah.
All right, we'll be back with Robert Hastings right after this.
Get it all. Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com.
Welcome back. My guest this evening is Robert Hastings. And just as we cut to break, I heard you say the echo is gone. That's good news. I hope it stays gone.
Knock wood.
Robert, now you've said that you've come to the conclusion that these are extraterrestrial craft. Do you know what Barry Goldwater thought about it? Have you heard? I ask that not because I have heard and am about to sneak an answer in here. I'm just curious. I haven't heard what he thought about it.
First of all, I don't claim to have read everything that he said publicly, but I do have in my possession letters that he wrote to a researcher named Lee Graham. I also have verbatim transcripts from two separate appearances he made on Larry King over the years, and he just simply referred to it as the UFO reality or the UFO phenomenon. Now, at one point, when King, I can't remember which transcript, but when King started pressing him about what he thought it was, he kind of stopped in mid-sentence and said something like, "I'm one that believes that there's life elsewhere in the universe." So I think he was clearly implying that his view was, or the rumors that he had heard suggested that these might be extraterrestrial craft. But that's an inference that I simply derived from that response in that particular conversation.
What about the two who are going to appear with you on Larry King? What do they think about it?
Actually, it's three people, and we haven't talked about the third one yet. Bob Salas will be with me. He was the Minuteman missile launch officer who was involved in one of two full flight, meaning all 10 missiles or close to all 10 missles dropped offline. Due to UFO activity, he is going to be one of the guests. The second gentleman is named Bob Jamison, and he was a targeting officer who was called in to bring up some of those missiles. And he is the one person that I've talked to who has said explicitly that they were told at the missile maintenance hangar that UFOs were involved in the shutdown incidents, that rather than going out to the field immediately to attempt to restart and retarget these missiles, they were going to be required to stay at the on base at Malmstrom in the missile maintenance hangar until all reports of UFO activity from the field ceased. And he said that just about the time they were about to leave, they were briefed that if they saw a UFO on the way out to the missiles, they were to report it over the radio. And if they saw one at the site while they were attempting to bring up the missiles, they were ordered to get into what's called the personnel access hatch and go down into the missile silo and get away from the UFO at topside. And Bob Jamison will be on the program saying presumably exactly what he told me in an interview that's in my book. The third person, and we're all Bobs, I go by Robert, but these other gentlemen are all Bobs. The third person is Dr. Bob Jacobs, who was involved in what's called the Big Sur incident, which, again, is a remarkable nuclear weapons-related case. At my website, which will be up this Friday, UFOHastings.com, I have a link to an article called The Big Sur Incident, and you'll find that I have interviewed Bob Jacobs at length. I found supporting documentation to support his story that while he was filming the test launch of an Atlas missile at Vandenberg Air Force Base in September 1964, they were testing a dummy nuclear warhead design. Jacobs and another Air Force officer who's now deceased, a man named Major Florenz Mansman, both of these two gentlemen say that when they examined the film, they found that a UFO, a disc with a dome structure on it, suddenly appeared in camera frame, flying alongside of the missile warhead, which had already separated and was flying downrange over the Pacific Ocean. Seconds later, this object, they were traveling, by the way, at about somewhere between 10 and 12,000 miles per hour, just a ridiculous speed. The UFO circled the dummy warhead, according to these two officers, and at four separate points flashed a bright flash of light at it. Like Jacob says, it looks sort of like lightning, but not quite, and then raced out of camera frame. And seconds later, the warhead, which was supposed to travel several hundred miles further downrange, suddenly started tumbling and fell into the Pacific Ocean hundreds of miles short of the target. Now, those are the people who are going to be on with me, and presumably, you know, in a Larry King program where everyone's talking and you only get a few seconds to present your case, you're not going to get a detailed summary of any of those incidents, but hopefully we'll be allowed to talk and to some degree and present these kinds of things to the American public.
Well, I've heard this story before, and about the missile being, if you will, shot down or disabled by a UFO. But this is the guy that was actually filming this. He was putting this on movie film, right?
That's correct. He was in charge of the team that photographed this through a high-powered telescope that was photographing the missile launch downrange. It was so powerful, such a powerful telescope, they could still see the warhead, which was about 11 feet in length at a distance of some 400 to 500 miles downrange. People now have seen pictures of rockets going off or the space shuttle going off when, you know, they're being photographed as they're leaving the Earth to go into orbit, and some of those are, you know, hundreds of miles away, too. They have very powerful optical systems that can track that. And Jacobs and Mansman wrote to each other about 20 years later, private correspondence, which I have copies of, in which two decades later, they're still talking to each other like, I can't believe that happened, you know, that we actually filmed that. They were just stunned, you know, quite obviously, two decades later. And those letters were just private exchanges. I'm the one that's published them. And Jacobs, again, like I do, believes that the public has the right to know the facts, that this is going on. Mansman was a little more concerned about repercussions. At one point, he told Jacobs he was concerned about the CIA coming down on him. So he was a little more reticent, but he did confirm on a number of occasions, as I state in my article, which again you can find at my website, that indeed this was a UFO that in effect shot down a dummy nuclear warhead with four beams of light. Both Jacobs and Mansman further say that one or two or three days after the incident, they screened the film in Mansman's office, and Jacobs has said there was two men sitting there in civilian clothes that weren't saying much, and it was only years later that Mansman told Jacobs in this letter that they were CIA agents, and after Jacobs was ordered not to talk about this and, you know, never discuss it, that once he was ordered to leave the office, these two gentlemen in civilian clothes took the film, cut out the part showing the UFO shooting down the warhead, and put it in a briefcase. Mansman has said that he signed off the release of the briefcase, and that film ended up presumably in Washington or somewhere else where it was analyzed.
All right. He was concerned, he wrote in a letter that he was concerned that he might get into some kind of problems from the CIA. Do you know if he did after he spoke out? Has he had any problems?
Well, again, he's deceased. He died in 2000, but to my knowledge, no, he never... he never was approached or leaned on. I did talk to his widow about a year and a half ago, and all she would tell me is that her husband, Florence Mansman, Major Mansman, knew far more than he revealed publicly. He knew far more than he confirmed in support of Jacob's story, and felt that he couldn't talk about it because he would get into trouble. But she didn't make any mention of anyone showing up and harassing him. On the other hand, Dr. Jacobs has written, there's some things online that he's written and has confirmed to me personally that when he in fact in, I want to say 1982, but it may have been a year or two later. He allowed his story to be published. He tried to get it published in Omni magazine, which was quite popular at the time. It was like a science fiction, science kind of magazine. They didn't pick up the story, so he ultimately allowed it to be picked up by the National Enquirer. And he said he hated the reputation of that paper because it was just considered to have a lot of nonsensical stories about UFOs, but they were the only one interested in publishing it. Omni did later publish a smaller, a shorter version of his story, and he has basically said that they were told, he was told by Major Mansman that the incident, quote, never happened. He was never told that it was top secret. It was just, it never happened, and you don't want to talk about it. So.
All right, we have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll open up the telephone lines for you to call in and talk with our guest, ask him questions, make comments. And you can also, if you're outside of the USA or outside of Canada, send me a flash message. We'll be back right after this.
Day. All right, we are back. My guest this evening is Robert Hastings, and we're talking about some pretty, I consider it to be pretty hairy stuff with UFOs hanging around nuclear missile sites. I think that's pretty hairy. Robert, we have a caller on hold, so let's go straight to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio.
Yes, Terry.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm the only one out here, but somehow that knowing that these guys can do that doesn't disturb me. It might be something we need just to step away from something horrible that could happen in the future. I know I would like to have them if we needed them, but if the people to be on all sides, if it's happening to everybody, knows that these things are being reprogrammed on a destination or shut down, or that they will be just that much less likely to use them.
So it doesn't bother you at all that the UFOs monkey around with the nuclear missiles?
Nope, not really. I figure if they're a threat, we'd already know about it. I think they're just trying to teach us something.
What do you think, Robert?
Well, I could only hear part of what he said. I take it that what I think I heard was his attitude is similar to mine in that if in fact this kind of event or activity is occurring at not only our missile sites but the Soviet and now the Russian missile sites, it's sort of an even-handed proposition, and that's the way I view it. I think, as Terry just said, if these critters were intending us harm, they would have made their move a long time ago. They seem to be engaged in what I consider to be display behavior, where they're playing this cat-and-mouse game. They'll do these very ostentatious daylight displays around the world from time to time, like in Mexico most recently over the last decade. And then at other times they're very stealthy and, nocturnal. They're only sighted in very remote places at 2 a.m. So I think what's going on is this on-again, off-again kind of activity or interaction with humanity that's short of open contact. And in my view and other people's views, they're just slowly acclimating humankind to their reality and their presence here. However, as a subset, based on my own research, it's quite clear that either one race or more than one race is also, in my view, again, attempting to send a message to mankind that nuclear weapons could be the end of us, that having them is essentially playing with fire, as I say in my book. Bob Salas and Bob Jacobs both agree with that. Bob Jacobs has said, I think somebody has, quote, fired a shot across the bow of our nuclear silliness ship. And, Bob Salas has said similar things. So I find it interesting. I would say 3 out of 4, roughly 75% of the former military people that I've interviewed are of the opinion that these are aliens, and what they're doing is sending us a message, heavy hints, so to speak, that in fact nuclear weapons should be eliminated because they will potentially be our downfall. Now, if indeed that is occurring, if that's what's going on, a message is being sent, look at who gets the message. The people out at the sites know about it. Their superiors know about it. Their superiors at the Pentagon know about it, but the relative number of people that know this is going on is just a handful. And I would say that, obviously the Pentagon and the CIA are probably not terribly happy with what I have been doing trying to publicize all of this.
I think that's the case, yeah.
That's their prerogative. My military sources believe, as I do, that, if this is a democracy, then this is something that needs to be a topic of public discussion. This is so dramatic. This is so over the top. It has sweeping implications, not only for our country, but the entire world. And, if whoever these guys are in the UFOs have been trying to nudge us and the Russians away from nukes for 60 years, and they haven't succeeded to the point where we still have thousands of nuclear weapons. Even though there's been a downsizing, we still have enough to incinerate the entire planet. If our military strategists at the Pentagon and the Russians at the Kremlin haven't gotten the message, then I think it's time to open up all of this activity to a wider public audience, not only in the U.S. but around the world, and let everybody in on the secret.
Speaking of a wider public audience, let's go back to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Trey in Atlanta.
Trey, you're going to have to speak up. It sounds like you're speaking through cotton from the bottom of a barrel.
Okay. Is this a little bit better, Kevin?
Not much, but go ahead.
Okay. The question I would like to ask is, has your guest heard of any, I know we don't get a lot of intelligence from Iran or any of that area, but any of their military bases or missile sites had similar activity to where they were shut down? And do you think there's a possibility that they're monitoring our nuclear weapons to make sure they can turn them off one day whenever we might want to use them to launch a counterattack?
All right. What do you think, Robert?
I personally cannot address the subject of UFO activity at foreign countries' nuclear weapons sites. I'm aware of articles online, on the web, indicating activity in Iranian airspace. I'm also aware of reports in Pakistan and India indicating UFO activity in their airspace. India and Pakistan have been, well, they both have nuclear weapons, and they've both been saber-rattling for the last decade or so and threatening to use them. Pakistan, of course, is a Muslim country. India is a Hindu country. They divided in 1947, I believe it was, when they were granted their independence, and they've been at each other's throats ever since, more or less. They fought, I believe, three or four wars since their independence in 47. And so they do have nukes. They have tested them underground in the recent past, and there have been reports of UFO activity not only in India but Pakistan. Now, in my view, what I've read online, you have to take with a grain of salt. There are some reports that seem to be quite credible. There are some other reports that just seem to be largely imaginative speculation on the part of the writers. But there do seem to be that activity going on. As to the second part of your question, whether whoever are tampering with our nukes plan to intervene at some point, that's the unknown question. It's clear based on my research, the testimony of these people that are coming forward, and the very few reports from the Soviet Union, that this activity has been going on. What it adds up to, what it means, I don't presume to know. I've given you my opinion about what I think it is, but, you know, as I've told people, to be fair, to look at the other side of the coin, it's, you know, I have no information that, you know, would refute the idea that these are hostile aliens who are planning to invade Earth, and they don't want to inherit a radioactive polluted planet, so they're not going to allow us to use our nukes. I mean, that's one conceivable scenario. I think that's not even a remote possibility that that's what's going on, but, you know, I certainly don't have any answers, and I would bet you that the people at the Pentagon and the CIA and in the Kremlin who are in the know about all of this don't really have most of the answers. But I would suggest, again, because of all of this display activity, not involving nuclear weapons, but where you have UFO sightings, where they're just up there kind of hanging around, letting people look at them above Mexico City or other large metropolitan areas. They're trying to get us used to the idea that they're real and they're here. And if you were planning to invade or do harm to the planet that you were hanging around, you wouldn't engage in that kind of open activity, I don't
think. Oh, I think you'd keep it a little bit of a secret.
Exactly.
Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Dave from Michigan. How you doing, Kevin?
Doing good, Dave.
I got a question for Mr. Hastings. I got a cabin up in northern Michigan, just kind of like behind the old Worksmith Air Force Base. And other than the so-called sighting on October 30th, 1975, where a KC-135 tanker supposedly chased this thing and was chased by this thing, and it was seen over the weapons storage area, I was wondering if he knew of any other incidents other than that one over this base or any other base in Michigan. My neighbors up there have the old timers that lived there for a long time. They said when that base was open, there was all kinds of different crazy things in the skies all the time. It seemed like every summer they were seeing stuff, but after the base closed, they didn't see anything anymore. I just wondered if you could comment.
All right, let's find out.
I think I heard most of that. That was pretty faint, but I believe you were asking about the cases up in northern Michigan. In my book, I discuss at length the cases that occurred at Wurtsmith Air Force Base in October of 1975. There was apparently two separate instances where a UFO hovered over the nuclear weapons storage area. Extremely bright light, making no noise. Some people said it had a faint helicopter sound. Other people said it was silent. But in any case, it hovered over the nuclear weapons storage area for a period of time and then raced away. There was a KC-135 tanker aircraft that was diverted to chase it over one of the Great Lakes. I don't recall off the top of my head which one. In any case, they tracked it on radar, and a report that's now been declassified, they said it was traveling at about 1,000 miles per hour, so it clearly was not a helicopter. I have also interviewed another guard who was guarding the weapons security area, who describes in that same general time frame, the fall of 75, another incident that's virtually identical to the one that's known about from declassified files, but the details of the incidents that he's describing are different enough to suggest to me that that's happened on a second occasion. The only other activity I'm aware of occurred at Kinchlow Air Force Base, which was at one time a B-52 bomber, strategic bomber base. They may have had B-47s there, but at least I believe they had B-52s. But in any case, I have one source who's talked about UFO hovering over that base's weapons storage area, where the nuclear weapons are stored, and that would have been 1962, which would have been, you know, more than a decade prior to the other incidents at Wurtsmith. Other than those series of incidents, I'm unaware of any military or nuclear weapons-related activity involving UFOs in the UP.
All right. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, this is Kevin from Iroquois Falls, Ontario.
All right, Kevin, you're going to have to speak up.
Yes.
I can't hear any of that.
Okay, this is Kevin from Iroquois Falls, Ontario, IFAS Director for Northeastern Ontario.
And?
Yes, first I'd like to wish Dick Criswell a speedy recovery. Get well soon, bud. And Mr. Hastings, a question I've asked a few times of a few people, who's piloting these vessels? I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, he wants to know who's piloting these things.
I don't know if he's been listening the entire program this evening, but again, I've studied this for 35 years. I've talked to several hundred military sources, 100 of whom were involved in nuclear weapons cases. They are of the opinion, I am of the opinion as well, that the technology that's involved, the craft are so superior aerodynamically and technologically in general that it clearly we're dealing with a source off the earth. They're not American, they're not Russian. There are some now theories theoretical physicists are kicking around involving what's called higher dimensional space. They think that Einstein had a pretty good idea of how the universe worked, but not entirely. And so in the last 20 years, there have been theories to propose this higher dimensional space. Long story short, if that exists, then faster than light travel is possible. So beings can come from other worlds in a very short period of time and return home. It won't take centuries because they won't be limited to light speed travel. But also some of the hyperspace theorists, the higher dimensional space theorists, propose that time travel may even be possible. So, you know, we're getting way out on the speculative end of things, but if indeed this new view of the universe, how it's constructed, is proven to be the case, you know, by our children or grandchildren or whatever, then it's not inconceivable that these may be time machines that are humans from the future coming back. I mean, I'm just covering all of the speculative possibilities. but they certainly aren't contemporary 20th or 21st century technology from any country on Earth. I think that's quite clear to people who are familiar with the radar data in particular, which, you know, I've interviewed radar controllers who were at Malmstrom when all the missile incidents were going on. In my book, there's a whole chapter devoted to what they told me, and one of them said point blank, we were tracking objects flying faster than the Blackbird, you know, which is the fastest aircraft on Earth. They were tracking objects above 2,400 miles per hour and, you know, zigzagging all over the radar screens around the same time frame that the missiles were being visited. So these clearly are not American secret weapons or Soviet or Russian devices.
I don't know if you know the name Ron Regeer.
I do.
Okay, you're familiar with who he is. He's been on this show, and you were talking about them tracking these vehicles traveling above 2,400 miles per hour. And Ron Regeer was talking about when he was working with the DSP spy satellite program, that he actually was the person who compiled the reports on fast walkers.
Right.
And that they had tracked them at 15,000 miles per hour and above.
I'm aware of that. I don't know. I can't off the top of my head. I've read some of those published information. I can't tell you whether he was talking about objects that were in Earth above the atmosphere or within the atmosphere itself. So you would know better than I on that. But
well, in that particular instance, it was not in Earth's atmosphere.
That was my point. I mm-hmm. think, as I understand it, they had two code names, Fast Walker and Slow Walker, for the type of objects they were tracking. In any case, yeah, I'm aware of extremely high velocities being reported. The eyewitnesses on the ground, even if they're Air Force pilots, can only estimate a speed if they see something, unless they have a radar confirmation. But again, this gentleman that I spoke with at Malmstrom, who's now retired, said that they tracked an object traveling, you know, some 300 miles faster than the fastest aircraft on Earth. I should also mention, since we're talking about this, just within the last 6 months, I came into a bit of luck and found a source that was at Bentwaters Air Force Base in England. Most of your listeners have probably heard about the Bentwaters case.
Yeah.
Woodbridge, Rendlesham Forest. The most publicized story is the object that landed in the woods, and Colonel Halt and his team went out and chased it and so on. What's not as well known is that there were sightings right around the nuclear weapons storage area on the base, and just within the last 6 months, I've talked to a number of the guards who were actually there at the time the activity was occurring, and I've also talked to two radar operators who were at the Bentwaters Tower, and both of them have told me, I've got them again on tape, and I've reported what they've told me verbatim in my book. They track an object that covered 120 miles in about 8 to 10 seconds. And one of the controllers said that on its return trip, it reversed its course. This was right around the Bentwaters base. On its return trip, it suddenly did a 90-degree right-angle turn at, again, you know, extremely high rate of speed. So they had known about that. You know, obviously, when they said they were surprised that no one debriefed them, and they made a pact among themselves that they weren't going to talk about it because they thought they'd lose their status as air traffic controllers. And they were surprised to hear later that some of the guards and Colonel Halt and his team were seeing UFOs. But they actually tracked one, and one of the controllers, his name is Ike Barker, said that just as they were tracking the object, he looked out over from the air traffic control tower's window over the field and saw hovering above the water tower on the base a round object. He said it looked like an orange basketball and was there for about 2 seconds hovering and then zipped away, and that was what they were tracking on radar at Bentwaters.
All right, we've got time to take another call here before we go to break. So, caller, you are on. Your first name and where are you calling from?
Kevin, it's Mark from Nashport, Ohio.
Okay, Mark.
Robert, I got a two-part question, and I'll take the answer offline here. It seems that there's so many retired military people coming out to tell the truth about UFOs, but on the other hand, it seems like much of our government is still ignorant of the UFO reality. Therefore, exactly what government agency do you think is responsible for maintaining the secrecy? And at this point, what is the point or the purpose of the secrecy? And I'll hang up and let another caller in.
All right. Thanks for the call.
I've been speaking on the college lecture circuit for 26 years, and I get that question and that series of questions in particular time and time again. What I tell people is this: probably only 1 in 1,000 Air Force personnel in the course of their service career have ever had a UFO experience. And I just pulled that number out of the air to illustrate that it's a very small percentage of people who either had experience or heard about an experience. So most of the people either, you know, at a low level enlisted men, even many, many officers have no idea that any of this is going on. They're not hiding anything. They're just totally unaware of it. Again, the secrecy is being kept on a need-to-know basis as much as possible. So very few people on any given case, on any given incident, are aware of what's going on. As far as who's running the show, who's coordinating the secrecy, in my view, based on anecdotal testimony of a number of retired military people and some researchers who've dug into it, in particular a man named Todd Zeckel, I think the Central Intelligence Agency has been more or less coordinating things in some respects, not military operations, but the acquiring and collating and collection and storing of data. I think the CIA is involved. In fact, I mentioned earlier, back in 64, Lieutenant Jacobs and Major Mansman said that the CIA took this film. And more recently, in 1986, a now-retired high-level FAA official, John Callahan, said that they were going to release radar data of a very spectacular UFO sighting in Alaska in November of 86. And they were about to release that and go public and say, you know, we tracked this object on radar. It was as big as an aircraft carrier and so on. And the CIA and the FBI and some other people from the Reagan White House, according to John Callahan, showed up at the FAA, had a meeting, and said, this meeting never happened. We weren't here. But by the way, you're not going to release anything to the public because there could be public panic. So again, you know, over a 20-year period, you've got people saying, the people who are saying the secrecy needs to be maintained and we're going to take the data, we're taking your tapes, we're taking your logs, we're CIA people. I think.
Well, I would see, to me, that makes sense. Because you have a, in the United States, the military is civilian controlled. At the very top, your commander in chief is civilian, and so they answer to a civilian commander in chief. They answer to civilians in the form of House of Representatives as well as Senate. And I would think that there would be a civilian or non-military component in the intelligence side as well. And see, that makes sense to me that it would be the CIA.
Well, that, again, you know, beyond theorizing, and again, I don't disagree with anything you've said, but, you know, when it comes to interviewing people who might have some knowledge of what's going on, they seem to be pointing the finger at CIA. I don't know if I have time before the break to address the last part of the question.
We've got about 2 minutes.
Okay, why the secrecy was the last part of the last caller's question. Why the secrecy? I think it's probably a combination of things. We have testimony from former Air Force personnel, a man named Captain Edward Ruppelt, who is involved in Project Blue Book, saying that the Pentagon was concerned for public panic if, in fact, the public was told these are alien visitors and, you know, their craft are so superior to ours, let's hope they're friendly because we can't do a damn thing about it if we're not, you know, if they're not. So you don't want to tell the public that. If indeed the Roswell object was an extraterrestrial craft, as I believe, based on some testimony that I present in my book and that gathered by other researchers, you certainly would, the military would try to capitalize on that hardware to create our own UFOs for future wars. So that we would have vastly superior technology, and if indeed you had something like that, you wouldn't want any, you know, your enemies to know. Certainly, you probably wouldn't even want your friends to know that you had that technology. So that's part of it. Victor Marchetti is a retired, well, actually, he left the CIA in the early 70s. Victor Marchetti wrote a book called The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence, best-selling book in the 70s. In 1979, Victor Marchetti, a former CIA official, said that the CIA treats the subject of UFOs very seriously. He said it's a subject so sensitive that you just don't talk about it. But he did say that while he was with the agency, he heard rumors about crashed UFOs and bodies of little men. And he did say those were rumors, but he said it was such a sensitive subject that you don't talk about it. But one other thing Marchetti said was, in his view, our government, the Russian government, all the governments who are in on the UFO secret don't want to risk losing their power, their status quo, their control over their respective citizens, and so they don't want to risk upsetting the apple cart, the international situation, and tell citizens everywhere in every country that, you know, there's a higher power and they're visiting us.
All right, we have to take a break, and we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back. My guest this evening is Robert Hastings, and we are talking about the interest that UFOs seem to have in nuclear stuff.
Robert, we've talked about most. Oh, by the way, before I ask that question, folks, the telephone number is 1-623-581-5148. It's right here on your screen. All right. 623-581-5148. So if you have a question or comment, please feel free to call in and ask Robert. And Robert, let me get to the question. We've talked a lot about the interest that these things seem to have in nuclear missile sites. Do you deal in your book with any of the UFO sightings around nuclear power plants?
Only in an appendix. I've not really studied those. They obviously seem to be a related type of activity to what I do study, but I simply haven't had the time or the sources, the inside sources involved in those kinds of incidents to really pursue them. So all I've done is really, in about 6 pages at the end of the book, cataloged some of the more publicized cases that have been reported by other researchers, principally Peter Davenport, of the National UFO Reporting Center.
One of the things that it sort of got my attention. We had a power outage, I guess you could say, and just before that, and there were some power lines that sort of exploded into fire, and it was all near our nuclear power plant out here in the Phoenix area. It's called the, I think it's called the Palo Verde.
Palo Verde, correct.
Yeah.
I mentioned two separate sighting reports dealing with Palo Verde. I wasn't aware of the incident that you'd mentioned.
Well, this was a couple of years back, and we heard reports that a UFO was seen, one or two UFOs seen, hovering in that area just before the incident.
It wouldn't surprise me, because those are the types of details that are provided by sighting witnesses in other cases. I think they were the ones in my book. Without looking, I couldn't tell you the dates, to be honest, but I believe they were in the late 90s and the early 2001, 2002 time frame. So I don't think that's the incident you're referring to. I will mention that I don't cover it in my book, but if anyone went to Google and typed in UFO Great Northeast Blackout 1965, you would find a wealth of information about an incident in November of 65 when UFOs were sighted above a Syracuse power relay station near a Niagara Falls, New York power generating station, and another UFO was sighted smack dab right above downtown Manhattan. And seconds after all of this happened, all of New York State and most of New England lost its power for about 12 hours. And there were reports of the UFO activity associated with the blackout. One of the major Boston newspapers had a front page story. The editors of that paper later told a researcher named Ray Fowler that after they published the UFO link to the blackout, they had gotten a call from a very irate officer at the Pentagon just saying, do not follow up on that. You shouldn't have published that. Do not follow up on it, and so on. So it got the Pentagon's attention. I have also interviewed a former Navy radar operator who was on duty that night up in Maine at a naval facility, and he said he told me that they tracked UFOs that night off the coast of Maine. They were clearly not aircraft by the maneuvers and the speeds they were exhibiting. So that was real, and there did seem to be a UFO link with that great blackout. As to why, I don't presume to know.
All right, let's go to the telephone caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin and Robert. This is Dale from Long Beach, Mississippi.
Okay, Dale, speak up good and loud for us.
Oh, okay. I wanted to ask Robert about, I noticed on the photo and video of the UFOs over the Capitol, there appears to be 11 UFOs in flight. Has anyone ever compared some of these sightings where there are multiple UFOs in a single event and compared the number of UFOs and its flight pattern to a star system, like a dot-to-dot for analysis?
In other words, if you did dot-to-dot, light-to-light, does it make the shape of a constellation? Is
exactly.
that what you're saying?
Exactly.
I've never heard that proposed. To tell you the truth, there was a site, there was a scene in Close Encounters where some UFOs formed the Big Dipper. I don't know if you remember that or not, but I've never heard that in reality. No.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Well, I just wanted your opinion on it, you know, and maybe it's something to look into.
You know, I think there is so much information about UFOs nowadays that any one person can't even know, even if they're diligent and pursue it on a daily basis. There's so much that's being reported. Some of it's accurate and credible, and a lot of it's not. But anyone such as myself who has pretty much done this full-time for 3.5 decades, I figure I know about maybe 5% of what's been reported in the last, 50 or 60 years. There's just so much going on, you can't keep track of it. No one can.
Dale, thank you for the call. The telephone number is on your screen if you're watching our video feed. It is, if you're not watching the video feed, 1-623-581-5148. I received a flash message asking me if we had done anything about reinstituting Skype. And the answer to that is we have not. Are we going to? Yes, we are. Skype really, it caused audio problems, and then when we added video, it really went crazy. And so what we're going to do is wait until we get our additional computer that has been donated for us. It's being prepared for us now. And then we will have three computers running. Skype will be handled by one computer, and that'll take care of the problems. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Mickey calling you from North Louisiana tonight.
Okay, Mickey, where in North Louisiana?
Near your old stomping grounds. I'm really near Dubuque.
I know all about Dubuque.
Well, I'm even more appropriately in Unionville, so...
All right, I know that area well. Yeah, for those who are not aware, I used to be a deputy sheriff in Monroe, Louisiana. Ouachita Parish.
Yeah, well, I'm calling you from Lincoln Parish tonight, and I'd like to ask the guest tonight if he knows who the designated poo-pooer is going to be on the Larry King Show this Friday, and also ask him if he could characterize the people who've appeared with him on various programs or whatever it may be, whose job it was to tell him that he was wrong. I'll hang up and take the answer off the air.
Oh, okay. who's going to be the designated poo-pooer?
I think your caller is psychic, because I was going to actually interrupt and mention that if the question didn't come up, so I'll segue right into that. Unfortunately, it's Bill Nye, the science guy.
Oh, and this is going to be fun.
Well, maybe. He was on 2 weeks ago, and, first of all, he made one factual error after another in the things he said himself, and I'll get to that in a second. But he also interrupted all the other guests. He was afraid to let people express contrary opinions, apparently. He kept interrupting former retired astronaut Edgar Mitchell, one of the men who walked on the moon. He interrupted him so much that Edgar Mitchell finally had to tell him to shut up in those terms. So I'm hoping to be polite, and I'm hoping to be professional on the show, but sometimes with somebody like Bill Nye, you just have to fight fire with fire. So,
well, you know, the word Nye means near, so I know it's spelled differently, so he's nearly the science guy.
Well, first of all, he made a number of factual errors, as I said. He was trying to explain away the Roswell recovery as what he was calling the Skyhook balloon. It was not the Skyhook balloon. Even the Air Force, in their cover-up, has said it was a what's called a Mogul balloon train, just a different animal altogether. It had nothing to do with Skyhook. Bill Nye went on to say that Steve Fawcett, the adventurer who did a lot of balloon flying and piloting, was lost last fall in a balloon crash. That's not true. He was in an aircraft crash. And then, the most ridiculous of all, Larry King's people, when people are talking, they put up what are called stock photos to try to represent or illustrate what a subject is. And they had some photos of a body on a gurney, and they also had a photo of a Viking lander in a crate that said NASA on the side or Viking on the side. And Bill Nye apparently thought that these were being presented as evidence of the Roswell crash. So he spent nearly a minute trying to explain away these NASA photos and these other stock photos as frauds and talking about how they were put together with a computer. And I mean, Bill Nye, the oblivious guy, you know. So, and then, you know, and he's the one that's going to tell the world what UFOs are, and you know, I don't think so. So
we really should thank Larry King for having such an uninformed and, from my opinion, this is my opinion, an idiot on the show in that position, because, you know, it really does that side of the argument. It gives them a great black eye, which they so soundly deserve. Let's go to let's go back to the phone. Yeah, go ahead.
I can understand that point of view. On the other hand, you know, I've been trying to bring credibility to the subject. There are legitimate skeptical points to be made about UFOs. And, you know, Seth Shostak, who is a SETI astronomer who was on last week, you know...
I hate to do it. We're into a break. We're going to have to cut it, and we'll pick up right there. Caller, if you'll hang on, we'll get you first up after the break.
Street, there's no going back for more. There's no going.
All right, we are back, and we are on final approach.
Let's go back to our guest, Robert Hastings, and let's see if our caller held on. Are you still with me?
Yeah, 10-4.
Okay, your first name, and where are you calling from?
Kevin Robert, this is Larry in California. How you doing?
Outstanding, Larry. Thanks for hanging on.
How are you? I'm just curious if, Robert, if you've done any research or investigations into the allegations of many, including John Lear, about a secret astronaut corps.
That one is a new wrinkle. However, I have to say, in my view, most of what I've heard John Lear claim over the last 20 years is not credible. I know, for example, that he was claiming a number of underground alien bases in the Southwest and so on. Well, if you trace all of those stories back, you come down to a guy named Richard Doty, who is an OSI agent at Kirtland Air Force Base. Some other researchers and I caught him in a number of lies. He's admitted to forging documents. He was the one that sent Linda Howe, researcher Linda Howe, astray with all sorts of crazy claims about the MJ-12 group, which is a bunch of bull, in my view. So a lot of disinformation, forged documents, and all of that story about underground bases that John Lear was promoting and publicizing. I think he was taken for a ride. He just didn't check into the credibility of his sources, and I think he was led around by the nose, unfortunately.
All right. Well, that's the only thing I had to question about.
Thanks. All right, Larry, thanks.
I did want to say something to the Louisiana caller and you, since you were both down there.
Yeah.
There were a number of sightings around Barksdale Air Force Base in Shreveport, which was, during the Cold War, a B-52 bomber squadron I'm aware of. I've spoken at LSU in Shreveport 3 times, and I've had stories from former Air Force people and even active duty Air Force people about UFO sightings around Barksdale when the bombers were there, the nuclear bombers. So again, you've got this nuclear weapons connection.
December the 24th, 1992, there was a major UFO sighting above Ouachita Parish and perhaps Lincoln Parish and Wynn Parish, but primarily Ouachita Parish. And I have received and have in the past, I have broadcast the scanner traffic of the deputies. It was the first Christmas Eve I had ever had off as a deputy sheriff. I was at home with my family. I didn't know anything about this till I got to work the next day. But I knew the people that were involved in it. And it's very interesting. They talk about it's at treetop level, just above the trees. It's gigantic. You hear them talking about cars going dead. You hear them talking about their radio had been dead and had just now begun to work again. But the most interesting thing to me about it was when a deputy asked the base to he asked headquarters to contact the airport and ask them if they're seeing anything on their radar. In just a few moments, the headquarters radios back and says, "We've contacted the air traffic control tower, and they say that there are no planes in the sky. They have nothing in showing up in the sky at this time," which is not unusual because that's not a busy airport.
Right.
And you hear the deputy say, "Headquarters, did I hear you correctly? They said they had nothing in the sky right now?" And she says, "That's correct." And he said, "Well, I'm watching 5 planes fly around this thing right now." And, you know, and they're saying they have nothing. It's not unusual to hear them say they did not get any radar reading on a UFO. We've
correct.
Heard that. But our planes, they get radar readings on.
least one of those Palo Verde cases that I have in my book, The Power Plant Near Phoenix. The object was apparently being chased or circled by what seemed to be military aircraft. And in the Phoenix Lights case, where this huge object flew over Phoenix, some eyewitnesses reported a jet taking off from Luke Air Force Base, an interceptor. Luke says not only did it, were there none of their jets flying up over the city, but, you know, they didn't have anything on radar and so on and so forth. In fact, the PR guy, the public relation guy at Luke, said that they didn't get a single call that night regarding lights in the sky or anything, and yet when Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center called Luke Switchboard, because he was getting reports of activity from people in Phoenix, he called and he said that the switchboard operator told him that she couldn't talk because they were being flooded with calls about the lights. So obviously, the Air Force was doing its standard, you know, we don't know anything routine.
Well, they were busy dropping flares.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, not only did they not have any planes up, they dropped flares without planes, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah,
actually,
quite interesting.
It was Edgar Mitchell flying over the city in a skyhook balloon.
Or Stephen Fawcett.
That's right.
Well, that is one of the things about this topic that's pretty interesting, is that you hear all of these stories that come out. And, you know, if you just think a little bit, you can see right through them. I have said so many times, Robert, while I don't like cover-ups, I understand if they need to use a cover story. I mean, if there's something about that that tells them they need to use a cover story, okay, I understand. But you know what? Get better script writers. You know, write some story that's at least a little bit plausible.
Right. Well, as I've told people for years now, my father was in the Air Force for 20 years. His father, my grandfather, was in the Army for 30 years. That's my background. And I'm not making anybody out to be the bad guys, but there's a fundamental philosophical difference in my view and my sources, my ex-military sources, with the official policy of secrecy implemented by our government. And we think, again, if indeed we have alien visitors, and if those alien visitors are temporarily shutting down our nuclear missiles, not only here, but across the ocean in Russia and Soviet Union, that's something that is planetary in nature. That is something that we all need to know about, one way or the other, calmly and cautiously. But our government, no government, should have the right to keep the world in the dark year after year, decade after decade.
We have about 2.5-3 minutes here, and let me ask a question that is a follow-on to what you just said. It is alleged, and there seems to be some credible evidence, that there was a secret meeting at the UN on February the 12th dealing with UFO disclosure, and that there was an outline, a plan, an agenda to begin acclimating the population of this planet to the idea that we are being visited by extraterrestrials. Have you heard about that, and if so, what do you think about that?
I read that. I can't vouch for the source. I can't even verify that I recall what the source of the story was, but I did read that recently within the last month or two. I would simply say I'm nearly 60 years old, and I've heard stories like that since at least the mid-70s, if not earlier. And, you know, variations on that story. Next year, the story's going to break. Next year, they're going to tell us all about it. Well, you know, like I said, the first time I heard that type of story was in the mid-70s. So I take all of those with a very large grain of salt. If it happens, great, because I think that's what needs to happen. You certainly aren't going to get any candor from the current administration in the United States. I mean, they lied to us about going to war in Iraq.
Well, and we didn't get it from the previous one and all the way back to Carter, who said he was going to. Hey, we're out of time. Thanks for being with us. Just stay on the line with me, if you will, for a moment.
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen,
I wish we had more time, but, you know, this happens to us every night. It's called the end of the show. I got to tell you quickly, our cable provider, Cox Cable, is doing some upgrades, and I think it's all fiber optics. And there's a chance that I may not be able to be live tomorrow night, but if not, we will have a rebroadcast scheduled to play. It'll play from my server, and I'll try to be live, all right? You be here, and we'll see what happens. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.